Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from nearly half a century of combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks and Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group. Listen live and join us in the chat at commandcontrolpower.com on the first Tuesday of every month. We also offer a weekly email newsletter, which includes show notes for each episode. Learn more at commandcontrolpower.com. And thanks for listening.
This week's Command Control Power is sponsored by Flexdesk. Flexdesk is your help desk support that grows with your company. Go to rootedconsulting.org/Flexdesk to get started today. So, Joe, we haven't brought out Joe's Peeves Corner in quite a while.
Got a lot of corners here. How many corners in this building?
You work in an octagon.
Right.
But I've got a little peeve, but it's really inside baseball. So it's a shout out to all of you who use Apple Remote Desktop. And it's one of those annoyances when you're on Apple Remote Desktop and there's multiple machines that you have access to via ARD. And you go when you select the machine, but the list is still populating. So you know you've selected server, for instance, in this case. But the line sort of jumps up and all of a sudden it says, sorry, you can't connect to your own machine. You know, it's like, And it drives me crazy. And you would only know this if you just used ARD a lot. There's no word for that, but it's annoying as hell.
Yeah, I think it's your impatience, Jerry. You just got to wait it out and wait for that list to build.
Yeah, you do have to wait for the list. I have cases where sometimes a machine will like appear and disappear repeatedly. You know, do you guys ever see that? This happens where, like, let's say you have a Mac at a client site. When you connect via VPN to their site, you know, you have their machine in your list to connect to over ARD. And then let's say they bring it into your shop, you know, in my case, and it's on the bench and now it's on our network. And we might boot that machine to one of our SciTool drives, and we have ARD access on that drive, say. So we have ARD access. The machine, you know, is responding via ARD, but the username and password are different now. And so what happens is, like, it will appear as a machine that can be controlled, but then there's no control. And then so it'll, like, appear in the list and then disappear, and it's in this, like, weird state. So you have to actually, like, get info on it and then change the username and password. And then, of course, they get it, you know, you fix it, they get it back, and then now your connection doesn't work, and you're trying to remember what their password is and whatever. That case, too, sometimes it will pop up and disappear, and, like, I'll double-click on something, and then it opens the wrong thing, just like you're saying. And not only, you know, even worse than, like, you can't control your own screen, it'll just open somebody's computer, and then I'm mousing over their screen, and they're like, what the heck, you know? Like, who's on my computer? I'm like, sorry, you know? And it's just, like, a weird situation when that happens, because, you know, it makes them realize that, like, they have no idea if you're connecting to their computer most of the time.
That's interesting. I haven't seen that exact issue, but I have seen where I'm at a client site, the list has populated and machines will go from dark blue to the light blue, meaning they're not accessible anymore and they don't have the proper credential. And then they'll fade back into dark blue again. And it's like, what the heck?
If we're going into ARD gripes, then I got one. Have you guys seen where it's in your list, you've connected to it before, but you go to connect and it says, cannot connect because this is not running Apple Remote Desktop or something to that effect, but you know it's in fact on. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but that's happened to me plenty of times. You literally have to go to the computer physically and go into sharing and uncheck and recheck remote management for it to work again, which defeats the whole purpose of remote access.
Right, exactly.
Fine tools, yes. Yeah.
I do have to say, to counteract all that, it has gotten a lot better. I mean, you guys probably remember the days when it was even worse than everything we just said, where, you know, I just feel like it was a lot glitchier. I would have that situation where, like, I'd open it and it would just be like, there's a problem in remote desktop, you know, and then your only choice was to quit. And you're like, what problem? Like, what are you talking about? You know, just weird, glitchy thing. I mean, so it does seem better in general. But yeah, it definitely still has its, like, fundamental quirks that will probably never go away.
Just to dovetail off of that conversation, if you are using Adigy for Mac remote managed support, they've got a new built-in client that actually uses the web browser for access. And when you can get access to a machine, it's lightning fast. It's so refreshing compared to things like TeamViewer or trying to use ARD or even Screen Connect. They have a new built-in client, which works really, really well. So thank you, Adigy.
That's a great tip, because oftentimes in the situation Sam mentioned where you get stuck and you're locked out of a machine, it's great, as we've talked about in the past, to have a second method of remote connection. And you may not even realize it, but when you've got Adigee on there, you have that option. So you just go in and you can, you know, there's a couple ways you can fix that. Like in the case of if you just want to get back in by ARD, you can actually run the ARD kickstart command from the terminal on that machine.
That's right.
Command line access, which is great. And then, you know, or just like you said, I mean, you could just remote in and toggle it that way. So, it's really nice. In fact, I used a feature of Adigee today. I didn't even think of it, but I had to run a command on the machine to get the output of the command and then report back for support. And I was able to, you know, not interrupt the user, not have to call and find time to do that. I just went into Adigee and used the command line. It was a really, really great option.
Yeah, it's great too. And you actually have root access. So that's a lot of fun.
This is just a PSA, because we kind of encountered this a few weeks ago here at SIMAC. We had an issue where, this rarely happens anymore, but clients had a USB printer connected to one of their Macs and they were using printer sharing. And I don't know about you guys, but I find that, you know, 99% of the time that printer sharing is turned on, it's just got turned on because a client thought that meant, oh yeah, I want to be able to print wirelessly. Like, I better turn this thing on. They don't actually need it. You know, it's like already a network printer and they just turn on printer sharing for no reason. In this case, it was being used. And so they had this USB connected printer to one of their machines and they were using printer sharing to share it out. And then they have these like two or three other Macs that are printing to that printer through printer sharing on the host Mac. And any number of things can be problematic with that. Like the machine could be sleeping, you know, the host machine, or just shut down, or, you know, whatever. But in this case, what it reminded me of was that you have to actually reconfigure printer sharing if you ever change the name of a Mac. So the host Mac is configured as, say, like users MacBook Pro, turn on printer sharing and you get everybody set up and everything's printing just fine. If you go into sharing preferences and you change the name of that user's MacBook Pro to, like, you know, Bob's MacBook Pro, the other machines on the network can't print to it using printer sharing because it's using the Bonjour name. Yeah. So just a PSA to keep that in mind, you know, for when those rare circumstances you're actually using printer sharing and you change the name of the machine. Or even worse, it'll just append the number one sometimes randomly, you know, how Macs do that. And that will cause it to stop working as well.
It's so annoying when you get into a client and every knucklehead in the organization has turned on printer sharing. And so you go to add a new printer and there's like all these printers being shared out and like, what the hell is this?
Right. Exactly. Or they've got the network one and the printer sharing one and it's configured using the printer sharing one. And you're like, well, that's great, but like 10 times is prone to failure. So like, let's just go ahead and turn this off. Yeah, so you had a couple more of these issues with the called the OS install MPKG can't be found or whatever.
It's missing or damaged. Right. Yes. One was just dropped off in my doorstep. And the question is not can we fix these? Of course we can, but how much can we charge and just still get away with it? I think that's that's the bigger question.
That's your answer to everything, Jerry. Well, no, it's a good question. I think our previous guest, Michael Thompson, would appreciate that. How much can we charge? You know, profit first. That's the question of the hour. The funny thing with these is the way that's worded, it's missing or damaged. It's like, well, I didn't ask for this. I didn't do anything to cause this. Like, Apple, you fix it. Basically, you said like, hey, do you want to update? And I said, yes, I do. And then I got this, you know? So it's frustrating for the user because they just get stuck and it's like, yeah, what's missing or damaged? Like, isn't that your job to figure out?
Well, the irony here is this client, who I haven't seen in several years, he's an attorney and he just dropped it off. He brought it down to the Apple store and they were moments away from nuking and paving his. She said, well, I could fix it, but your data won't be there once I'm done.
You choose. It's like, yeah, leave it up to the client to make that decision. I love that. I mean, that's like their answer to everything, you know, as we've belabored on the show before. The nuke and pave, you know, it's like step one, you know, nuke and pave. Step two.
But we've seen so many of these. How could they even be puzzled seeing these? I mean, you would think that there'd be an internal document that Apple would issue. This is what you get to bang out in terminal. If this looks good, this is how you fix it. This is how you keep the customer's data safe. But you just don't fall back what you learned in training and just say, oh, we just got to wipe the drive and put on a new version of the OS. Anybody could do that. My 10-year-old could do that.
Exactly. I mean, that's a really good point, though. As you mentioned, like for us to be seeing a fair number of these, you know, Apple sees probably 100x of whatever we see, you know, I figure like if we see it five times a year, they see it like five times a week or something. I mean, whatever the ratio is. And for something like this, where we've all seen it multiple times and it's just at random, it seems to happen in spurts. It's like, you know, like you said, there must be a document on it by now, or at least they've seen it before. So yeah, it's kind of surprising. I mean, that may just be their recommended option. Answer, nuke and pave. But so anyway, I saw one of these just a couple days ago. We had a client drop off a Mac to us because, you know, this issue came to our workbench. I ended up taking a look at it first. So I tried to reboot and hold down option. And I tried to boot to, like, I figured I'll boot to our side tool or just, you know, other method of attack there. And I got the firmware password. This client had a firmware password set on this iMac, and it was a 21.5-inch 2013 model. And so I said, okay, well, you know, let me give him a call, get the password. None of the passwords he had provided up front had worked for that. So I said, let me find out what the firmware password is. And he said, well, slight problem. My former employer, big organization. This was his home machine at his house, but it was owned by his former employer. And his contact there had said, you know, like, if you don't return it to us, you know, like, we'll just kind of like forget this ever happened kind of thing. Like, basically, they kind of unofficially, like, you know, gave him this iMac, but it had firmware password set. So now he's in this quandary where he got stuck based on Apple's update failing, has no option to, you know, recover from this scenario, can't boot to another drive for repairing it or anything like that. Basically would then be left in the state where his only choice would be to do the Apple solution of erasing and restoring. We didn't want to do that because, of course, he didn't have a backup. All right, let me like go back to the drawing board and think about this for a little bit. So when you get to this state, you're essentially, is this correct? Like, you're booted to the recovery partition, it seems like. I think that's like actually running from the recovery partition. Could go into the utilities menu and open up like terminal. So we did that. I thought maybe I could fix this on the command line. So I don't remember as many times we've dealt with this, what the correct fix is. I mean, Jerry, do you have like a recipe for dealing with this?
Well, the first thing I try is I would try to reinstall the OS with an installer key.
Okay.
And obviously that won't remove the client's data. But with my last go round with this, I had found that the drive conversion to APFS didn't complete successfully. And it was sort of in a limbo state. So what I needed to do to resolve that, finish the conversion via terminal, and then I was successful to move forward. However, with that particular Mac, I had to force unmount the drive before I could try to even do a repair on it in terminal, whereas the Mac that was delivered to me today, I was able to boot to recovery partition and ran disk utility and they told me the drive was fine. So I think that the conversion to APFS on this MacBook Air that I'm looking at converted fine. So, you know, my go-to at this point will be from a USB installer key.
So exactly. So, you know, I was like at step zero of attempting, you know, that approach. And of course, I got stuck with the firmware password. So then I thought I had read these instructions previously on how to do this from the terminal, essentially to just sort of like abort the update. And this it would not apply probably in your case where the APFS, you know, had not finished migration and you were kind of in that limbo state. But in other cases where it's booting properly and it's just like you sort of want to just like abort the update and then just go back to the OS you were running previously, apparently you can essentially remove the contents of the /library/updates folder and then remove, it's at the root level, macOS install data folder. So I attempted this. So basically both of those folders existed and it appeared the contents of the library updates folder were empty. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that was the problem, but the /macOS install data folder was there. So I ran these two commands using terminal from the recovery partition to basically remove the contents of these two folders. Actually, I just renamed the macOS install data one in case I needed to get that back for whatever reason. And I thought, okay, here goes nothing. I'll restart. And I restarted, I got a do not enter symbol. So I was basically now going backwards. And so I now had a non-booting machine that was locked with a firmware password.
Wow.
So, yeah. So now I'm stuck and I'm like, well, listen, man, like, you know, no, all bets are off. You have no backup, and it's essentially a, you know, it's not a stolen machine, but like from Apple's perspective, like this is going to be really hard to work around because you don't have a proof of purchase. And so there's no way to basically reset the firmware password.
Just to stop right there for a moment, take a pause. The thing you would want to do is you'd want to bring the machine down to Apple, and Apple can, they have a workaround where they can bypass the firmware password and get you back on the road. But like you said, because he had no proof of purchase and he kind of snuck the computer out the door, right. Don't ask, don't tell,
right.
He couldn't do that.
Precisely. Yeah. Thank you. And it, you know, in fact, to your point, we had a client once who made a little bit of a scene at the Apple store when former sort of like partner at the company had previously purchased one of the MacBooks and, you know, had set a firmware password and whatever else, then had like left the organization. And so the proof of purchase was not officially, you know, available. It was not in the company's name and so on. And the CEO of the company went into the Apple store and, you know, said, okay, here's the Mac, it's locked, you know, unlock it for me, please. And they said, okay, where's your proof of purchase? And she said, well, you know, we don't have it. She explained the situation. They said, well, we can't do anything about it, sorry. And she said, you can't or you won't? Well, we can't, we just can't. And she was like, well, what if he died? You could bring in like a notice that would allow us to like give some kind of evidence that this, you know, should be like an exception and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, so it's not that you can't, it's that you won't. And the person is like, this is like a logical, you know, semantic like word game that she's like playing with the Apple person, eventually like convincing them that basically because they have the ability to unlock it for her, like they should go ahead and do that. And she mm-hmm. got her way. So, you know, there is a way to do it. Like you can walk into the store and you can present whatever evidence they need. In this case, the most easiest thing would be a proof of purchase. He basically would not want to get into it with the Apple store at that point. So, you know, we might be stuck. So what did we do? Despite the fact that this is a 2012 or 2013 Mac, you know, that needs to have the adhesive sliced and you know, that whole process of disassembly, we took the hard drive out and we attached it using an external enclosure to a host iMac, you know, probably could have been any Mac, you know, standard Mac. And we booted that machine to our installer drive, just like you said, installed the latest 10.13 over the top of the existing system, booted that drive. So now it's up to date, it's running, it's booting just fine, installed updates, you know, tested it for a couple of reboots, it was all good, put it back in the original host Mac. And now we're kind of like crossing our fingers, like, is this thing, you know, is it basically, is the firmware password going to allow it to boot to this disk, which is connected over the SATA bus? Like, is it restricted based on the disk identifier where it is on the SATA bus? Or is it like the GUID, you know, either of which would work? Or is it like something on the disk that allows it to, you know, to proceed? So mm-hmm. we were kind of 50-50. We thought it should work, and sure enough, it did. So it, you know, we booted before sealing it back up. We booted it up, and it ran just fine. And so we sealed it up, and it's good as new. You know, it's in working order. So we got around that issue.
Another satisfied customer.
Yeah.
Now let me just say this about that. I mean, no, that's a great success story. Thinking sort of out of the box or out of the Mac, so to speak. Right. But you know, I've always found the firmware password to be a bit of an annoyance. It's one of those things where people who think they're really clever and they read MacRumors.com, you know, and they're being smart, they invoke the firmware password. And more often than not, it just comes back to bite you in the butt.
Right, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Where either it's forgotten, sometimes you can get in and like in your case and there's a happy ending to it. And sometimes you're locked out and you can't do proof of purchase. If you want to be clever, turn on FileVault and call it a day.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And even then, you know, we always tell people we have to hedge that too, because it's going to come back to bite you. If you don't have really good backups, makes it that much harder to help you. Not that you should be relying on like data recovery to get your data back generally, but you know, with FileVault, I mean, forget about, you know, recovering data in any kind of like edge case scenario or failing drive or whatever. So especially like you said, with the firmware password, if you really want to, you can get around it. You know, I can understand in some organizations where, you know, you might have kids that know a little too much about computers and, you know, it is useful in those cases. But, you know, anybody who really wants to get in can get in.
Coming full circle to this ongoing failed High Sierra installation problems, you know, obviously yours was a special case and took a lot more labor hours. But what give me a round number. My Joe Saponari number for fixing this for this client who dropped off his computer this afternoon is three bills. You know, I figure,
you're not far off. Yeah. We have a labor rate here, you know, and for this kind of thing, we charged, I think, like an hour and a half because we're taking the drive out. We're putting in another machine. We're installing, you know, that was after like a couple of failed approaches and you know, from different attempts. And then after like, you know, doing the work and getting the drive back in, reassembling it and retesting. So, it was a pretty involved thing. It's like, how much did this free Mac just cost you today, you know?
Yeah, no, I think for the work that you described, it should be much more than that. But I'm just talking about, you know, fixing these.
Just
these
straightforward one.
Like your story, like your favorite story. Well, you know, why did you charge me this much to push the button?
Right.
You know, yeah, this is what Michael Thompson calls margin, but in this case, it's profit margin.
Exactly right. Got to have profit margin. I mean, you know, I agree. We've been through this enough to now not have to bang our heads on it for 3 or 4 hours, you know, and you can get a working computer back pretty quickly, thanks to bringing it into us because we see this, because we do this professionally. And so we can optimize the process in ideally 1 hour. I mean, it wouldn't be much less than that, you know. So Sam, have you seen any of these issues yet? I know the last time we talked about it, you hadn't yet seen this OS installation failed, missing or damaged situation before.
This actually just happened to one of my clients over the weekend. I think he rebooted. And at that point, that's when they got the message that the High Sierra installation failed. Exact same message that you guys have been describing. That was the first instance of us seeing that. You know, it was an odd one. One of my guys helped him over the weekend, which he texted us. Before I could say, do not reply, he replied right away.
Oh, man.
That was the first instance I had come across a situation like that. But you guys have seen a lot more of them in the field than I have.
Yeah, somewhat surprisingly, and like to Jerry's point earlier, you'd think Apple would be seeing more of these, you know, at the store. And it seems like they still don't have a great, like, easy solution for it. So
they don't have a handle on how to handle them. You know, this could be like a Tim Cook mitzvah. You know, where he's just trying to push a little money to the consultants and, yeah, you know, we'll send out a bad installer.
Right.
Let these guys make a little bit of cash.
That's a positive way to look at the QA issues that Apple's been having. You know, it's funny because we complain either way. You know, people like other fellow consultants oftentimes are like, you know, moaning about like, I don't get any work from the Apple stores. And, you know, and like Apple, what has Apple done for me lately? You know, and then their quality assurance goes down and we get all the calls and therefore billable hours to fix it. And then we're like, oh, Apple, they can't get anything right.
What the hell?
You know? Yeah, right. It's funny. They can't win, really. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor this week, Flexdesk from Rooted Consulting. Flexdesk is a flexible help desk service supported by the highly qualified and experienced team at Rooted Consulting. Flexdesk allows you to quickly and easily scale your business without having to hire a full-time employee. By using the Flexdesk service, it allows you to focus on customer support, it gives you peace of mind, and it allows you to provide a great customer experience.
In fact, we recently had the opportunity to interview Jeremy LeCompte and Daniel Allen of Flexdesk on episode 248, and they explained to us the nature of their service and how it worked for their customers and be that first line of defense when people call in, so you're left to do your job and concentrate on your tasks when you're on site at a client.
The primary purpose of Flexdesk would be tier one, tier two, business clients as well as residential clients. Because we are a consultancy as well as a Flexdesk outsource, we do have the ability to schedule level three support when necessary and when able, something that we offer as a Flexdesk solution.
Absolutely. Everyone on our team is at least macOS Support Essentials certified. Many of us have much more than that.
With your direction, Rooted Consulting will familiarize themselves with your customers and integrate themselves into your business. Rooted Consulting responds to tickets, answers phone calls, and supports your customers just like you would. To get started with Rooted Consulting's Flexdesk, go to rootedconsulting.org/Flexdesk.
I got a good one here for Joe's Tech Clinic, to bring back another recurring segment here. And this is actually somewhat relevant. Jerry, you were talking about the downloads folder last week. You had to add the downloads folder to the doc in the last show.
Client basically had their downloads folder represented as a stack, and inadvertently they had put an alias in the doc of a document, and they thought they kept on clicking on the downloads folder, and every single document right. In the downloads folder was the document that was in the doc.
All right. So if that wasn't weird enough, I have a really crazy tech clinic segment here for you, and it relates to downloads. So this user had upgraded his home iMac to High Sierra, started to notice immediately upon startup, the dock would be slow to respond, and then supposedly also the Finder as well. I've seen stuff like this. It wasn't clear exactly what was causing this at first and what the exact symptoms were, but he was describing that, like, you know, you just cold boot, start up the Mac, and it takes a long time for the Finder and the dock to become responsive. It would be fine for a while. And then this was the really weird part, where he would download a file, and it could be anything. It could be an image, it could be a PDF, it could be whatever. Just anything he went to download would then cause the dock to become unresponsive for like a matter of anywhere from like a few seconds to minutes. So we first tried to reproduce the problem and found that it wasn't actually happening. So we're like, oh great, you know, this is like not only a really weird issue that he's seeing, but it's just not happening. So we thought maybe there's something environmental. Does he have a hard drive connected or some weird stuff that's going on in his home? But eventually we were able to reproduce at least the part where consistently when we went to download a file, and it seemed like we had to do it using Safari, and then we did experience it in Chrome occasionally too, but we would download a file with Safari and it would cause the dock, sure enough, to become unresponsive. We could reproduce this. We, you know, his dock is at the bottom, so you go, you know, mouse down there and kind of mouse over the dock. And as you go across the dock, it's pretty quick to show the labels for each of the icons, right? As you're mousing, you know, back and forth across the dock. What I would do is I'd go to like, you know, our homepage, for example, and then go to download an image on the page, download linked file or download image or whatever. You'd see the image fly over into the dock, click the download, right? And then I'd immediately mouse down over the dock and start moving the mouse back and forth across the dock. And you'd see it updating. As soon as the download like flew, so this is like within a matter of milliseconds, you know, as soon as the download flew over to the desktop, as I'm mousing across the dock, whatever label I was, you know, whatever icon I was hovering over, the label would get stuck. And then I'd be mousing back and forth and it would just not be updating. Can't click anything. Of course, the dock also is related to a lot of other functions like mission control, command tab, and things like that. So basically the whole system would essentially feel like it's locked up in various ways. But it's really just the dock that's just totally stuck. It was always reproducible at this point, but sometimes it would be like a couple seconds of just the label being stuck. And then you, you know, keep moving the mouse around the dock. And eventually, like after a few seconds, it would start updating. And occasionally it would be like a matter of like a minute and you'd be mousing across the dock and like nothing would be happening. You're just waiting. And finally it just responds. So I'm like, this is really weird. At least now I can reproduce it and it's happening very consistently. So at least I know I can throw everything at it and see, you know, finally something should work. So I tried everything. I tried resetting launch services because I figured that's sometimes related to like weird dock issues and icon issues and things. I tried removing the contents of var folders, except the ZZ folder. Thanks, Dave Provine. you know, my old favorite trick there, and that did not work. Tried a safe boot, nothing. Tried resetting NVRAM, resetting the SMC, nothing. Installed all the updates, no change. I thought, all right, well, you know, dock preference file, like maybe that's it. He had a lot of stuff in the dock and stuff. So I took a screenshot of the dock using Command-Shift-4. You know, do you guys know this trick? You can press Command-Shift-4 and then press the space bar, obviously, to get the little camera icon. You can mouse over a window and click to take a picture of just that window. You can also do that with the dock. So you just hover over the dock and click, or the menu bar, or just various other pieces of the interface. So I just took a picture of the dock, then I just painstakingly recreated the dock. So I deleted the preference file, restarted the Mac just to get a nice fresh start, and confirmed that the dock came up with the generic icons in it, rebuilt the dock entirely, and retested everything. In fact, in this process, I noticed that he did not have his downloads folder in the dock. So I removed the downloads folder from the dock. I made it like just the way he had it. That was a clue. The other thing I noticed prior to all this was that he actually had his default location set to download to the desktop in both Safari and Chrome. So in troubleshooting, one of the first things I did was I changed it back to downloads. I'm like, well, maybe there's a weird bug or something. You know, maybe we just change it back and see. But it was the same issue. Whether he's downloading a file to his desktop or to the downloads folder, same result. You know, weird, sticky dock. You know, it goes unresponsive as soon as you download something. So I rebuilt the dock, still having the same issue. So I'm just like, if it's not the dock preferences, if it's like none of these system items, you know, what else could it be? You know? And so finally I thought, like, what else is different? You know, his downloads folder I had set back to desktop because, like, that was his preference. And, you know, but what else is different? Well, he doesn't have the folders, either the desktop folder or the downloads folder in his dock. I'm like, that can't be it. You know, I'm like, if you go to download something, sure, Safari's going to say, hey, put this item in the downloads folder or put this item on the desktop. And I assume the dock is, like, watching whatever locations of the folders you have in the dock are. You know, it's like if you have the downloads folder in the dock, you figure the dock is watching the downloads folder. And when something goes into the downloads folder, it will display in the dock. Like you were saying, Jerry, like with the stack or whatever format that folder is in, that's how the dock will get the update. If it's not there, you know, it should be irrelevant. The dock doesn't care that something was added to, you know, your downloads folder, let alone your desktop. Like, who cares, right? I was like, well, on a whim, I'm like, let me just try it. So I add both the desktop folder and the downloads folder to the dock, and I go to download something, and it's instantaneous, and the dock never goes unresponsive, and it's totally fixed.
Get out of town.
Tell me about it.
You added them both in. Did you try just the desktop since that was his default location?
No, I really wish I did now. But at that point, I was just like, okay, it's fixed. I'm not changing anything. Here's your computer.
I'm out.
Right. Yep. So I was just like happy enough with that. And I figure, you know, this must be a bug. I mean, maybe in the future we can like remove these folders from the dock and still have good performance. I mean, maybe it's an interaction between like having a different location set and like not having the downloads folder in the dock or not having the desktop or the folder you set. I don't know. I mean, there's obviously a slightly non-standard setup, but I just would never have imagined that that's an edge case that Apple didn't test for, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of nutty, man. I have not seen that. And I'm trying to think. I don't think I've ever gone into a situation where that's happened and the downloads folder hasn't even been there. So I'd be curious to see if you just for the hell of it, man, go in there and remove the downloads folder and see if just the desktop folder would suffice.
Yeah, I definitely
do it for me.
That. I will.
Do it for me. Do it for the show, Joe. Do it for the show.
I will. I for sure will.
That's absolutely bizarre. With the amount of time that you spend on this, you probably could have solved it by reinstalling the OS.
I wonder. I mean, yeah, but see, the thing is, that wouldn't affect his user account. So, you know, I still would have had to, you know, maybe it would have worked anyway. I don't know. It's a good thought. That was going to be my other thing. It's just like throwing everything at it. You know, that's probably what I was going to do next.
Or the thing that you do quite frequently was as well as you just create a new user folder and then...
Correct. Yeah, I could. And then, you know, migrate his stuff over. But, you know, then again, if his dock is set to not have that folder being displayed, I mean, I imagine, you know, it would have been a similar issue, right? I would have had to probably add that folder, possibly.
But if you just created a new user folder and then pointed the contents there, right, it would reassign all the permissions again. And maybe it's just was simply a permissions issue.
Exactly. I mean, it could have been something else. But I'm just going on the theory that, well, I mean, if you guys want to try this, you know, maybe remove your downloads folder from the dock and
hell no,
you know, try and download something and see if your dock locks up. Or better yet, change your location to download to the desktop and then, you know, remove both the desktop and downloads folder from the dock.
Yeah, I mean, that's an odd thing. I mean, we see lots of clients that download to the desktop. I mean, that seems to be a frequent home user kind of thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see too many, but I do see of anything besides downloads, obviously desktop's a good, you know, because that used to be where things went, I think, right, way back when.
We had a lot of fun last week talking to Justin Maxwell from Smith AI with his virtual receptionist product, and also he's rolled out Keypad, which is a cloud phone system for small businesses. Justin, as you heard early on in his introduction, worked at Apple. We were talking to him a little bit more after we were done recording, and we got him to tell a few stories. So we'd like to share that with you now. Justin, can you regale us with any juicy Apple stories that are
statute of limitations?
That's exactly.
You know, it's funny. When I think juicy, Apple wasn't much of a juicy place. The thing that I remember most fondly is that we were all extremely terrified of ever being caught in an elevator with Steve. And so I worked in Infinite Loop 3, and I often had to go over to Infinite Loop 1. Many times I would walk over to the elevator and see him walking over there too, and then quickly head towards the stairs so I was not going to be in an elevator with him, because it's so bad that like I was even afraid of this. I was only in my 20s at the time, and basically, the rumor was that he would ask you what you do and dress you down appropriately if you did not answer in an impressive way. That's all I have to say about that.
No, I actually heard that story, Justin. Yeah. I heard that from someone else at Apple that said that that was a famous story of if you ran into Steve Jobs in an elevator, you could end up without a job by the time you got out of that elevator.
Yeah, that's a much better way of saying it other than a 20-year-old running away from an elevator because there was another man in it.
It gives the elevator pitch a whole new meaning. I mean, these days it's like, you know, an elevator pitch is about trying to get a job or get funding for something. Back then, I guess it was about, you know, the elevator pitch was like keeping your job. You better hope that, you know, you have a good enough pitch to keep your job.
It was a really special time being there. It's when the company was completely changing its identity. In the last year that I was there was when the iPhone came out. And during that time, my wife and I had worked on our own little internal iPhone app, and we had made the first ever iPhone-based theremin, and we were so proud of it. And of course, we couldn't release it or anything like that because we were Apple employees. It was a very exciting time to be there because we were watching the world transform to handheld devices.
Now, when you first started at Apple, Emilio was gone, right? Completely gone.
Yes. I started there in 2003 to mark that in time. I think in my first year there, it was still the Mac versus PC campaign going on. It was right around when we first launched iTunes for Windows as well.
So there was a lot of momentum and a lot of excitement, I would imagine, on a day-to-day basis, just going to work and good company morale. And I would imagine that was missing for many, many years prior to that.
To cynical, I'd say it's missing again because it was full on the success of the underdog mentality there. We had a common enemy still, which was Microsoft, but we were gaining traction. Everything that we were doing was beautiful and being heralded by the press. The dawn of the tech fanboy. It's when John Gruber had finally kind of made the leap into making Daring Fireball his full-time gig. So all of this was the momentum around Apple. And so us being part of it felt like you were part of an extremely important movement. One of the things that I think was most special about it was it's very hard to understand this now, but at the time, Apple had a very singular brand. And so now it's very common to see people on Twitter putting their company's names behind them, like engineer at Google or designer at Apple or designer at Microsoft or Google, you know, Facebook and things like that. But Apple had a very, very strict policy about not bringing your personal identity into what you do. And it wasn't for the sake of security or privacy or any of the things that you might think. It was because Apple believed that the most powerful way to convey the brand was that we were all part of the company as a whole. And that was a singular identity. So the way that that played out internally was when you were working on something, like let's say, for example, I was working on the website for Aperture, I had this really strong understanding that I was part of a gigantic supply chain that made Aperture happen, right? Like I wasn't some designer who was going to go and post my screenshots to friends and be like, look, I worked on this thing. It was all about like someone somewhere had a seed of an idea. The seed of that idea became this software. That software now has a box and a disk and packaging and everyone's working on that. And it's all working towards this singular event, which is going to be the release of Aperture software. You are just like one tiny gear in that gigantic machine. So being part of that machine and the momentum around it at the time was just amazing.
Yeah, the whole is much greater than the parts. What you're seeing now, to put words in your mouth, is you're seeing a lot of dissemination in the not only the product line, but also the branding of the company.
Absolutely. As we talk, I'm sitting here with like surrounded by Apple devices. So they still have a very prominent role in my life. But I certainly think that just through their own success, they can no longer be the underdog. And therefore, they have to maintain that lead through a different strategy than they had back then.
It is really interesting to think back to that time frame. I was just looking through some old photos, and one set of photos was from when I just started my business and went to, my first Macworld. I think it was 2006, and the big, huge announcement was the Intel processor being in the Mac.
I was at Apple when that happened. All right, I'm going to try to get this story straight for you. So I was working on iLife 06. So it was the, you know, remember the iLife suite, which
oh,
was
yeah. Oh, of course.
All these things.
When you had to buy iPhoto way back then.
Yeah.
Right. So we were building the entire iLife website in Flash.
Wow.
All right. and you know where this is heading. This is around October 2005. I don't remember how that all worked. So let's say October 2005, we got notice in late October that Adobe had decided to not release the Flash plugin for our new Intel processors. So that was when a gigantic war then started between Apple and Adobe. Well, I guess continued. A new phase of an ongoing war between Apple and Adobe continued over this. And so we had to scrap every single thing that we were doing, rebuild the entire site of our marketing materials, scripted QuickTime. So none of us left. So we all worked over Thanksgiving vacation, then all through December, then all through Christmas break, redoing everything that we'd built. That was basically because otherwise we would have had a website that wouldn't run. So of course, this war was still brewing. Apple was super mad. We recreated this thing perfectly. Like, you wouldn't have even been able to tell that it was no longer built in Flash. And we released it the morning of Macworld, and Steve hated it, everything that we did, within 2 minutes of it launching. Man. And we had to scrap all of that work that we did, and we had to build an entirely new website in a single day.
Oh, man.
Wow. And that's a story, my friend.
And that's what working at Apple was like.
Wow. Wow. Oh, man. And you didn't get to take any credit for any of it anyway, so...
Oh, no. Ouch. I made sure to keep a QuickTime screen recording of just myself walking through the website so I could just look at it and cry for the rest of my life, knowing how much work we'd spent on that.
Aesthetics, right? He just didn't like the way it was laid out, and he just wanted everything built differently.
It was a circus. I mean, essentially, the website, we were launching, I think, there was the new iMac that had the Intel processors. It was a really beautiful, it was the flat screen iMac. So the website was just like animated this and film reels shooting in from the right, and every button was flashy. And like, at the time, Apple had just hired a bunch of really talented motion designers. The short answer is Apple was just a little bit ahead of its time. Yes, that's really where the web is now, with motion everywhere, but it was pretty grotesque to be launching a website like that with everything flying in at once back then.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a different era. To think back, the processor was the big story. You know, I mean, that was like a full year before the iPhone announcement. Pre-iPhone, it's just like hard for a lot of people to imagine. Regular people associate Apple with iPhone now. You know, I've been a Mac guy a long time, and Apple went from being thought of as the iPod company. I would talk about Mac and they'd be like, oh, what do you mean, the iPod people? Or like the iPod store, you know, when it was the Apple store in the mall, they called it the iPod store. You know, at some point it switched to like, oh, you mean the iPhone store. Eventually now I think people call them Mac as if that's the company name, but you know, they've come a long way, and it's hard to imagine they went from being that underdog, barely surviving company little more than a decade ago to being the world's highest value company, best brand recognition.
You hear these famous stories about how Steve Jobs would just kill something because he hated it, that you were firsthand a part of that, one of those tremendous chop downs by Steve Jobs. That's a rough one, but amazing to hear.
For me, it was always the second degree, I guess. Every significant Steve interaction I had would come through my manager, because they had worked together at Next. And so there would just be these days where my manager would just kind of come in shaking his head, and he'd be like, Steve called me when I was in the shower this morning, so I've been talking to him soaking wet for the past hour, and you guys are now going to change everything. Many conversations like that where like someone would have to go over to his house at 4 a.m. to fix something. All of this was because, I know I sound like every other fanboy, but he was almost always right. And that's the crazy thing about this, is there was a level of, I guess for the past couple of years, the big hype in the design field has been all about like empathy and knowing the user and, you know, not pretending to be the user. But Steve actually was both the driver of the company and the number one user rolled into one. So whenever he actually had a very strong opinion about something, it was because he was trying to represent the user. And like, I'd say 90% of the time it was on target. You know, the only thing that Apple really had a weak spot back then was around connected services and understanding how the internet exists outside the world of Apple. But that certainly hasn't really slowed the company down much.
Well, it's definitely a rite of passage to have gone through that kind of era where, you know, your work was being critiqued by Steve Jobs and, you know, some of your stuff just thrown out the window. That is an amazing thing to have gone through. So that's very cool. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure thing.
And thanks again to Rooted Consulting's FlexDesk. To learn more, go to rootedconsulting.org/FlexDesk.